Welcome to Speaking Truth to Empire on 88.1 KFCF Free Speech Radio for Central California. My name is Danny Yassin. I am an anti-war, anti-militarism, and anti-empire activist. Mike Rhodes is at the controls. Today is August 19th, 2015, third Wednesday of the month. Every third Wednesday from 3 to 3:30 p.m., I interview authors, scholars, bloggers, columnists, and activists who help us look at our world through the prism of American imperialism. On the show, we talk about U.S. foreign and domestic policies and the actions of the military-industrial surveillance security complex. These actions have severe consequences for the people all over the world. To create a better, humane, and a compassionate world, we must first understand what is being done in our name, and we must always be willing to stand up, speak out, and speak truth to empire. Today we have Finian Cunningham on telephone with us. Hello, Finian.
Hello, John.
Thank you for being my guest on Speaking Truth to Empire. Originally from Belfast, Ireland, Finian Cunningham is an author, columnist, and a media commentator.
Mm-hmm. You're welcome.
He was expelled from Bahrain in June 2011 for his critical journalism in which he highlighted human rights violation by the Western-backed regime. He has a master's degree in agricultural chemistry and worked as a scientific editor for the Royal Society of Chemistry in Cambridge, England, before pursuing a career in journalism. For many years, he worked as an editor and writer in the mainstream media, including The Mirror, The Irish Times, and The Independent. Now, he writes extensively on international affairs. His articles appear on Global Research, Counterpunch, Information Clearinghouse, RT, and NSNBC International, which is a daily international online newspaper. He is now based in East Africa, where he's writing a book on Bahrain and the Arab Spring. He is also a musician and songwriter. Finian, let's start with early 2011 when Arab Spring came to Bahrain. You wrote many articles about the brutal crackdown of the protesters by Bahraini government. Your criticism of the government led to your expulsion from Bahrain. You are writing a book about it. When and where the book will be available? And talk to us about what happened in Bahrain at that time.
Well, Dan, thanks for having me on your show, and good day to your listeners. Yes, I started covering the whole upheaval in Bahrain in, you know, early 2011, because I was there anyway. I was working as a journalist in Bahrain, and then the whole protest movement erupted. It was actually on Valentine's Day, February 14, 2011. In Bahrain. Now, the whole region, starting from Tunisia, spreading to Egypt, down to Yemen, and then across to Bahrain and a few other Middle Eastern countries, the whole region had erupted, and Bahrain followed in the wake of the eruption of protests. And the Bahraini regime, it's a royal family, you know, it's a dictatorship, really, with a veneer of parliamentary democracy, but it's really a royal family, an autocratic monarchy that runs Bahrain as a kingdom, like the other Persian Gulf monarchies, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Kuwait, the United Arab Emirates, and Oman. So the regime in Bahrain, which is backed to the hilt by the United States of America and Britain, militarily, financially, and economically, It's back to the hilt, and politically and diplomatically, it's back to the hilt by Washington and London. And the regime cracked down really mercilessly against peaceful, against the peaceful protesters was vicious. You know, people were rounded up, thrown into jails. People were shot dead on the street. Not in massive numbers as in some other countries, but it was vicious crackdown. And they did it with a green light from Washington and London and the bigger Persian Gulf ally of the West, Saudi Arabia. So the regime continues to this day cracking down mercilessly on the population of Bahrain. You know, hundreds of people are in jail, you know, without any due process. They're just thrown in to jail detention and tortured, systematically tortured by the regime. And they continue to do this with a green light, a very cynical blind eye from Washington and London.
Okay, Finian, you just wrote an article about the Iran deal. You have a very different take on the deal. How do you see the Iran deal?
Well, it's a sort of a wait and see situation, Dan. I mean, I think all the best analysts that are out there are trying to get their head around what the implications of this deal, what the underlying motives of it are. I can't really give a definitive answer at this stage because it's all unfolding. I mean, the preliminary deal that was signed in Switzerland there last month, it might not even get through the United States Congress. The Republican-controlled Congress is threatening to axe whatever, you know, deal on paper the Obama administration came up with the other members of the P5 plus one group. That's Russia, China, Britain, France, and Germany with Iran. They signed this joint plan of action, joint comprehensive plan of action, I think it was in Vienna last month. And the deal on paper might get axed. So, you know, we'll have to wait and see what the Congress does about that in next month when they go to vote on it. And even if they if they succeed in axing it, President Obama is saying that he will exercise a veto power to push the deal through. But even that is, you know, at risk of being not getting the past the two-thirds quorum in the Congress for his veto to succeed. Now, that might kind of suggest that the Obama administration wants a deal for, inherently good reasons, you know, normalizing relations with Iran. The Republicans in the Congress, as far as I can tell, are just, you know, viscerally knee-jerk, hawkish reaction to any kind of deal with Iran, and they're heavily influenced by the Israeli, the Zionist lobby in the lobbies of Congress, as well as the Saudi oil lobby. So the Congress has got an outright hawkish attitude towards any kind of deal with the Islamic Republic of Iran. Now, that doesn't mean to say the White House has got a benevolent motivation. I mean, I think they are playing a more subtle form of geopolitical chess. They want to try to normalize relations with Iran to a certain degree, but not for the reason of, you know, normalizing relations in any kind of benevolent way. The nuclear deal could be seen as a way of the Washington government trying to just exert some kind of control over Iran by putting restrictions on the country's quite legitimate nuclear program, this nuclear energy development program is quite legitimate under the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Iran shouldn't have gone through all this hoops and hurdles and a decade or more of sanctions to achieve the right to enrich uranium and to develop its civilian nuclear program. But anyway, the restrictions that are in place with the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action that was signed in Vienna last month, those restrictions will possibly, very possibly, give the American government control over Iran in dictating the implementation of the deal, and in particular on the issue of sanctions relief. The deal, from what I can, from what I understand, is very much predicated on Iran fulfilling certain implementation terms, restrictions on its nuclear program, and then reciprocal to that, then the Washington will lift certain, the sanctions, its economic and financial sanctions on Iran. But this could lead to another, just another procrastination of, normalizing relations. I mean, Washington can kind of make trouble for Iran and allege that it's not fulfilling its side of the bargain and therefore sanctions will not be lifted. Obama is talking about a gradual lifting of sanctions over, several years. This could drag on. It's not immediately a full breakthrough in sanctions relief for Iran. So Washington could be just using the deal as a way of trying to, revamp its kind of political, geopolitical control over Iran. But that could lead to problems because the deal itself, as it's signed, does allow for the other international powers, Russia and China in particular, to resume trade and financial transactions with Iran. So Washington could find itself, and it could find itself actually quite isolated if it didn't fulfil the deal for what it's worth, because the other countries, the other powers, also the Europeans, are very keen to try to get their foot in the door with Iran to invest and develop industrial, connections and trade with Iran. So we'll have to see, Dan. I really, it's at this stage, we just have to see how it pans out.
Okay. You are listening to Speaking Truth to Empire on 88.1 KFCF Free Speech Radio for Central California. We are speaking with Finian Cunningham, an author, columnist, and a media commentator. Few weeks ago, you wrote a great article, Can America Evolve with Russia and the Rest of Humanity? You start with stating a fact that many people miss, that America is the only country whose leaders are always talking about war, terrorism, enmity, and hostilities, while Russia, China, and other countries are talking about partnership, development, progress, prosperity, and peace. Give us a summary of that article.
Well, as you pointed out, Dan, it's becoming more and more apparent that Washington and the Pentagon just seem to have a one-track mind. It's always about projecting the world as a dangerous place full of dangerous enemies, and they have singled out Russia and China, and actually Iran. Again, there's a contradiction with the nuclear deal that we talked about previously. I mean, in recent statements from the Pentagon, they've actually they specified Iran as a world an international threat to American interests. The top ones being Russia and China. And this is just a recurring mantra that the American ruling class, the government, and the military people continually harp on about, that you know, the dangers of the world and the threats from other countries. And you know, the thing is that there's very little in the way of evidence produced to try and kind of verify or to substantiate those claims. It's just continual allegations and you know, alleged threats from other countries. And you know, I mean, I think it's quite telling. It should be very telling that this is a belligerent attitude that's become very much center stage in the American ruling class system. I mean, it's always been there. America, the United States, has carried out more wars and aggression than any other country on the planet, going back almost all of its 300-year history. And William Blum, the American historian, has documented this very comprehensively. Since the Second World War, the United States has been involved in something like 50 major wars or conflicts, as well as dozens of subversions and dirty war and covert war operations. And when you add it all up, I mean, no other country on earth is comparable to the United States for its record of aggression and destruction in international relations. So it's really quite, you know, it's really quite sickening when you hear Washington officials and with their very, you know, apparently erudite, you know, benign appearance, talking about international law and peace and threats from other countries, when the United States government itself, you know, stands accused of being a rogue state, a state sponsor of terrorism. And that's not hyperbole. It's not, you know, just, I'm not just throwing out slanderous comments here. You can verify the accusation that the United States government is the world's biggest state sponsor of terrorism, and you can verify that with the historical record of its interference all around the planet for the last 50, 60 years.
We just commemorated the anniversaries of war crimes and crimes against humanities committed by the American government against the people of Japan and Vietnam. You have recently written about both countries and the crimes that I just mentioned. Let's first talk about the atomic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Just give us your take, because we have learned so much more since then about the narrative that U.S. America developed and the denial and the cover-up.
Well, if you're prepared to be open-minded and to examine historical records with an open mind and an objective attitude, I think it's unmistakable. It's hard to ignore the conclusion that the United States really carried out the atomic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki in 1945, August 1945, killing at least 200,000 people almost immediately, and several more thousands of people over subsequent decades. You know, the United States carried that out not to end the Pacific War with Japan, but really with an eye to deter the Soviet Union in some sort of perceived approach to the post-war world carve-up. So the United States proceeded to drop the atomic bombs on Japan, really as a demonstration of raw power. This was a new weapon, incomparably powerful weapon, and it was used as an instrument of terror by the United States government, with a very much the eye on Russia's reaction to that. The Japanese were defeated well before August 1945 when they dropped the bombs. I don't want to go into all the historical details because we haven't got time, but if you look up people like Professor Gar Oprowitz, he's an American historian. There are several other eminent historians out there who have compended the historical record. And the Japanese were ready to surrender early in 1945. Don't forget, there was a massive campaign of firebombing of Japanese cities, Tokyo in particular, in which the same number of people were killed as in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Whole cities were destroyed in a massive aerial campaign of firebombing, which is a huge war crime, we should note. I mean, this isn't just kind of like an acts of violence that you can get away with in conducting a war. These are crimes against humanity as outlined by the Geneva Convention and other international law. To target civilian centers, as the Americans did in Japan, both by firebombing and dropping atomic weapons on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, were huge crimes against humanity. There is no way that you can try to justify what happened as some kind of attempt to end the Pacific War with Japan. The official doctrine, the official narrative claims that these acts of violence were done so as to terminate the Pacific War quickly and to save American lives, the lives of American troops who were going to then invade mainland Japan. That's what's claimed. But if you can look into the historical record with an open mind, you will see that the claim was really a false, hollow claim. It was just a pretext to go ahead with a massive demonstration of military power. And as I said, the main concern of the United States and Britain at the time was to circumvent Russia from expanding any further than it had out of the Pacific War, the war lines. The Soviet Union had really defeated Nazi Germany in May 1945. It was the Soviets who actually bore the brunt of that war. Nearly 30 million Soviet citizens were killed in the Second World War against Nazi Germany, as against less than a million of the American and British forces. So the Russians, the Soviet Union, really won the war. And the Western allies, Washington and London, were very concerned that the Soviet Union, when it would enter the Pacific War against Japan in the middle of August, as it was scheduled, the Western allies and the Soviet allies, they were allied with the Soviets, of course, at that time. In the Potsdam Conference in July 1945, a couple of months after the defeat of Nazi Germany, the three big allies negotiated that the Soviet Union would enter the Pacific War against Japan in the middle of August. And just before the Soviet Union, at the time of its entering into the Pacific War, then the Americans went ahead and dropped the atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The Americans were not scheduled to invade mainland Japan until November 1945. So one immediately asked the question, why did they rush ahead to drop these two horrific weapons on Japan? I think the historical record, the historical details, the correspondence, the memos of the various meetings show that the British and the Americans did not want the Soviet Union to gain on Japan, taking territories like Manchuria, invading into Korea to take what was then a Japanese colony, and to expand against Japan's crumbling colonial empire at the expense of Washington and its British ally. And that's why they precipitously went ahead with dropping the atomic weapons to really finalize the demarcation of where the Allies were at that time, to stop the Soviets from expanding, taking any further territory in the Pacific.
We have a couple of minutes, Finian, so I just need one more question to ask you. Under the leadership of Barack Obama, America has done everything possible to simultaneously alienate and antagonize both Russia and China, and the consequences of this policy could result in a World War III, which will definitely be nuclear. How do you see this scenario unfolding?
Yeah. Well, as you say, Dan, I mean, the Washington government is going out of its way to antagonize Russia and China. The Obama administration is really embarking on a reckless path of antagonism towards Russia and China. The Americans, with their Western allies, have subverted Ukraine. They installed a neo-Nazi regime in Kiev, the capital of Ukraine, in February of 2014. They overthrew an elected government right on the doorstep of Russia. And it's quite obvious that the US-led NATO military alliance is gunning with Russia. They are conducting massive military maneuvers all around the Russia's territory, Ukraine in particular, you know, subverting the government there on the doorstep
Finian,
of Russia.
Finian, we have just antagonistic. I mean, we have just less than a minute, so wrap it up.
Right. Now, you look at China. The president of China, Xi Jinping, is due to come into Washington next month. Mm-hmm. Already, the Washington apparatus of media and pundits are ratcheting up an agenda of aggression towards the Chinese president, you know, accusing China of aggression in or expansion in the Pacific.
Thank you so much, Finian. We need to stop. Thank you for your time. Thank you for being my guest on this show. And I'll be looking forward to your next article. You have been listening to Speaking Truth to Empire on 88.1 KFCF Free Speech Radio for Central California. We were speaking with Finian Cunningham, an author, columnist, and a media commentator. My name is Dan Yassin, host of the show. Until next month, goodbye.